My tongue speaks so they will know, giving voice to the legacy that has come before. Sojourner, Ida, Dorothy, Mary, Ella, Maya Angelou, others left out of history books, many refusing to, denying my humanity, but I stand and demand. From birthing of a civilization to nurturing a nation, we've been right here. I breast the comfort of men and suckling babies. How dare they not see me? Strength, genius, and beauty. I give voice to this beautiful struggle to shine and bring forth the light, staking claim to our birthright and inheritance of this earth, an overflow of compassion and justice. Using my voice to tell the children, telling the stories of black excellence, Africans, speaking truth to power, if only for 1 hour, they will stop and know that. My tongue speaks so they will know that. Ain't I a woman?
This is Voices of Advocacy Radio with your host, Lakeisha Gray Sewell, showcasing leading activists, community servants, and entrepreneurs. You are now tuned in to truth, community passion, and amplified legacy. Can you hear it? It's Voices of Advocacy Radio.
Voices of Advocacy Radio is just exceedingly pleased to have with us just a phenomenal expert and gifted professional whose insight guides so much of our community practice in terms of mental wellness and well-being. And so, without further ado, I just want to welcome to Voices of Advocacy Radio Dr. Karen Taylor Crawford. Dr. Crawford is a child and adolescent psychiatrist in private practice on the southwest side of Chicago. She is a retired assistant professor of child psychiatry at University of Illinois College of Medicine in Chicago. She's done extensive clinical research, articles, also co-authored a book. Dr. Crawford, you are a peer to some well-renowned psychiatrists and definitely hold your weight and your insight. And so, and one being Dr. Carl Bell, I just want to welcome you and thank you so much for taking the time as we delve into this very, very important conversation about the things that are impacting our girls today, even as we speak. So thank you and welcome to Voices of Advocacy Radio.
Thank you so much, Lakeisha, for having me.
Absolutely. I'm just going to delve right in, Dr. Crawford. We've seen in the news almost consistently and almost on a programmatic, almost as if it's being by design, programmatically, these images of black girls being assaulted, brutalized in very combative instances with authority figures and law enforcement. We've had the case that happened in early June in McKinney, Texas, with the young sister there who was beaten and brutalized, not just by police, but also by some civilians. Right. We also had the very same thing happen within a few days of that incident in Ohio at another poolside. And we've just gotten the news of the sister, Sandra Bland, who is actually from the Chicagoland area, making a trip to Texas, stopped by police with an encounter for not using a turn signal correctly, and then found 3 days later, arrested. Video surfaces of her being also brutalized and just violently handled by police, and then 3 days later found dead in her jail cell. And so we have to delve into this question because these things are happening to those individuals, but there's also an audience of young girls and young people in general, but there's an audience who is taking this all in, and so that's what we need to talk about. How does this impact them? How do we shore them up? How do we, you know, how do we prepare them for this world where this is what they see and then what other people are seeing about them? So I'm diving right in. How do these images, Dr. Crawford, whether they see them through the social media or if it's you hanging out, walking down the street and your girlfriend is stopped by police and is, you know, accosted by police, how do these images impact our girls in their psyche?
Well, I think they impact them very negatively. The trauma that is induced by these images is quite significant. for the individual, and it indeed puts these young people at a readiness for further trauma, which then, you know, negates what may be some of their resilience and their protective factors in dealing with persons in authority. By that, I mean, if you see other young women who are being brutalized for very, very minor offenses, if you could call them offenses at all, then it makes the young person think, what might happen to me? And when indeed something occurs, it any small assault, verbally or physically, becomes magnified, and you get a magnified response, one of terror versus one of compliance or one of quiet resistance. If you feel your life is in jeopardy, it is hard to think rationally about, okay, what's the next step? When you know there's no protection, when you know, at least you feel, that there's no one there to come to your aid, then you're pushed into a state of terror. And so the response is to either run away or totally shut down, both of which can be misinterpreted by the police officer. When you shut down, it's seen as being resistant versus being fearful. When you try to escape, it's interpreted as being maybe that you're trying to escape being discovered for something you're guilty of that they had no way of knowing, you know, before you were accosted, that indeed you had perpetrated, or that you're resisting arrest, and any resistance is perceived as a threat against the police officer.
Absolutely. And so we know that this is having an impact on those girls who are in that predicament, and we also know that, like you said, it's preparing them for that time when they're this image, this reminder of what has happened historically with other girls or other people in police custody, that this could possibly happen to me. And so my defense mechanism is to either shut down or to just completely not comply at all and fight or flight, basically.
Correct. I had an incident. I just have to say, I'm in Minnesota. I'm at the National Brotherhood of Cyclists, which is the National Black Cyclist Organization. Very friendly group of people. Minnesota tends to be a very nice place. People are very polite. Went to a community gathering today. The police officers were helping to direct traffic in this neighborhood gathering. Very, very warm and friendly people. And yet I was at a barbecue given by the organizers of the conference, where a employee of the university, of the culinary staff, was bringing in tables and you know, helping to bring equipment that was going to be used to serve others. And we had ridden up on our bicycles, and we were in the driveway, and this man rolled down the window, and he was an African-American male. Again, this is a group of black women and men, but more women. And it was like maybe if there were five people standing out in the driveway, three were women, two were men. Okay. And he's like, I'm tired. Why don't you get out of my way? And my response was, well, good evening. Would you like for us to move? Of course we'd be glad to comply. And he just kept fussing. We subsequently saw the same gentleman at the university where we were having a lecture being given on aging and the impact of lifelong exercise, you know, what the health benefits were. And I saw the same gentleman, as I said, he was part of the culinary staff at the university. And I said, oh, did you get some rest? And he kind of looked at me. I said, remember, you were really tired the other day and screaming about us moving out of the driveway? Oh, yeah, I got some rest. And, you know, again, my attempt to engage him the night where we were standing in the driveway, he continued to be quite abusive. Now, again, the other people kind of moved aside and didn't say anything, and no one, you know, made any comments. The home where we were being entertained was a white gentleman who's a supporter of this black organization.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, they work. This is a college town, and so, you know, people who do culinary work often, you know, have side jobs, and so that's where they had met this gentleman. And this was his side job. This was not his university job. So again, he was making some extra money by doing a side job. So it's like, hey, you know, you may have needed some rest, but, you know, brother, this is your second job, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The nature of having a second job is you may be tired after your first job when you do your second job. Mm-hmm. Why are you screaming at me? So, again, being a mature African-American, you know, I'm a senior. I'm a woman who works with people every day. My specialty is disruptive behavior disorders with youth. So when you scream and holler at me, my attitude is the only thing I can control is my attitude, and I'm going to ask you to control yours.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not in any way apologize because, again, we all have bad times. We all have off times. And we, you know, then go, oh, you're right. I'm sorry. My bad. You know, thank you very much for moving. But he just continued to fuss. Now, again, this is an African-American man with an African-American senior woman. Imagine what happens when you are an African-American teenager interacting with a senior authority white male. And when he starts screaming and hollering at you and you go, are you talking to me? It just escalates. And again, the young person, because their perception is, I was just standing here. I wasn't doing anything really wrong. And yet you're treating me as if I am a criminal. And then when you are arrested, it's like, what? Is this an altered reality? How did I get to be a criminal?
Mm-hmm.
I was just standing here. I was just, you know, doing what I thought was normal. Yes, I might have been inappropriately there. I shouldn't have been in the driveway. But because I was in a casual setting and I accidentally did not move with alacrity, did that mean that I should be subject to your wrath? And if a police officer then gets angrier and angrier, again, that fight or flight or sense of, oh my God, what's going to happen, and fear gripping you where you feel immobilized, just as escalated 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I imagine for this young woman and the young woman who allegedly hung herself in the cell at Texas, who was a resident of Naperville, who was moving to Texas where she had gone to undergraduate school, was returning to the area to start a new job, had a minor traffic violation, to have the police officer, after she, I guess, got out of the car, when he stopped the car to give her a moving violation, then moves to take her down to the ground and presses her head against the, you know, knocks her head against the ground. What is crossing the median line repeatedly? How severe a traffic violation is that, that you have to put your hands on me? That you have
did
to...
Did I even have to get out the car? Did I even have to exit my car? That you can't just take my license, my registration, write my ticket, and let me go on about my business?
Correct. And so, again, that you then move into a sense of, oh, my God, what is going to happen next? Because this doesn't fit. Nothing's fitting. And now I feel my life is in danger over what? What is going on here? What has this got to do with who I am? Where are the stops? Where are the safety gaps? Who's going to be here to protect me? Because this is crazy. This has nothing to do with what normal reality should be.
Exactly. And then, Dr. Crocker, when you couple that with the fact that you've seen this play out in other instances, so you know, this is happening to you now, but you, in your mind, is playing out what has happened, you know, to other people prior to you. You've just seen this very same thing the week before, and then you've seen the same thing the week before that. Your friends have gone through it, and you know that it hasn't wound up in a favorable place for your friends. So that also, as you said before, that also kind of informs how you feel. That informs not just fear, but then you have fear coupled with outrage, because it is absurd that I have to even step out of my car. It's absurd that I have to leave the pool. It's absurd that I have to argue with other adults. So this whole thing now, as you said, is not just fear of your life, but also the anger that you feel. And how do you even direct anger or channel anger when there's an authority figure who ultimately at that point has the right, the
complete control over your life.
Yeah,
complete
over
control.
That moment. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. And I've been stopped by the police. I remember a few years back, I had a dog. I was walking the dog on a Sunday morning at 6:30 a.m., three blocks from my house. And the Metro police, because I was getting ready to walk across Metro tracks, pulled up. He had a gun. He unclipped his gun. He didn't pull his gun out of the holster, but he unclipped it, called got on the radio and called and said, "Female black, I may need backup." And then proceeded to ask me, where was my ID? 6:30 in the morning, walking my dog on a Sunday? I didn't have any ID. And yet, this man perceived me as a threat, because I was about to cross, walk over the Metro tracks to a grassy area, walking my dog. I was like, you have got to be kidding me.
And there is nothing that will prepare you to have an ID to walk your dog. And we know, and this is the thing that incenses people, this is the reaction, because we know, had you been white, more than likely, there's that small 0.999%. that you would have been stopped. But more than likely, you wouldn't have been stopped. You wouldn't have been asked for any type of identification just to walk your dog at 6 o'clock in the morning. In fact, it would have been, are you okay? You know, it would have been more concern for your safety versus you being perceived as a threat to anybody else's safety. And so with that, the next question that I have for you is, like, is there validity to this thought that if you are seeing the very same thing in the news, as other black women and black girls, if this same thing is being played over and over, especially in a small length of time, like a small window of time where you have 1 month and you have four black girls who are apprehended, accosted, and two wind up dead at the hands of the police, does this do something to the collective psyche of black girls?
I think it has to. Even if you thought before this that those situations were ridiculous, that something was being misrepresented, because, of course, the police officers who are there to serve and protect would never act in that way. When they then begin to act as if you're a criminal, and you have to flip and go, oh, my God, everything I thought about that other woman and how she must have been inappropriate, I'm totally wrong. Oh, my God, how far can this go? I have no control over this. Because I thought that other woman must have done something totally inappropriate for that police officer to respond in that way. But I know what I've done, and I have done nothing to provoke this kind of response. Oh, my God, what is going to happen next?
What's going to happen next? And then can it be said that this could possibly stifle, as you talked about, the resiliency of girls? Could this even stifle just the natural assertiveness, just the natural, like you said, protection, the self-defense of yourself, to stand up and be able to articulate when you feel there's an injustice, to articulate when you feel that something is unfair, to even just ask, you know, officer, why? Or officer, what did I do? Do you think that this stifles that girls then feel like they should not speak out at all? That you know, that this is, that in a way that this can be seen as some type of intimidation tactics?
Well, I won't even speak to the intimidation tactic because I think that then infers intent on the part of the police officer. And I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I have some suspicions based on my own experience with police officers, but I don't know. So I'm not going to even go there. But what it does is then it puts you in a situation that whenever you're in a situation with persons of authority, a classroom, a store, you know, walking across the street, you then start to question, should I say anything? If I have a question, should I say anything? Because if I voice a concern that I think is appropriate, but the other person perceives as aggressive, are they going to shut me down? And if they are going to shut me down, what's going to be the ultimate response to my assertiveness? So then I think you see young people who don't speak up in class, who don't ask questions, who don't ask teachers for help, who get lost or go into a public situation and other kids are acting up and they go, now, I know my friends. I don't know these police officers. I know what's right. I know what's wrong. But push come to shove, if I have to choose between hanging with my friends who I know will protect me or attempt to protect me versus doing the right thing and being in a situation where I have alienated myself from my friends and I cannot trust to have an alliance with the person of authority, I will be totally out here. I would rather go out and act a fool with my friends because at least I know they will be, they will have my back. But even if I'm right, and the person in authority sees that I'm doing the right thing, they're still going to retaliate against me as if I'm just as guilty as everybody else.
Wow.
And at least I don't have to feel like I've been singled out.
Whoa. Now, that's let's stay right there and dig into that because that is really, I need teachers to hear that. I need administrators to hear that. I need mentors to hear that. I need everybody who has girls who are serving girls to hear that. So what you're basically saying is that if a girl is in your presence, in your institution, your organization, your program, your classroom, that there may be two things. There may be times when she is feeling a way, she has input, she wants to articulate something, she has an opinion, a strong opinion about something, she may very well swallow it and silence herself because the fear of authority based on what she's seen, you know, historically, every day in reality and in media images about authority figures and girls. She may very well silence herself.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
I see it all the time. I don't just see it in black girls. I see it in in general where they've been in situations where they voice their opinion. And when it is in conflict with the person in authority then doesn't gently challenge or say, let's explore this, but they say, how dare you say that?
Mm-hmm.
With the implication, you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're wrong.
But in relationship to black girls, based on what they're seeing so much of, just this, not just saying don't question, don't talk back, but seeing it take a step further where there's violence, where there's death that can come across from, you know, interactions with, especially law enforcement, but with authorities. Do you think that has a greater impact on our girls? Because, you know, it's a different thing than somebody ignoring you and shutting you down versus somebody killing you for speaking out.
Or, yes, absolutely. You know, I had the experience this year. Well, one, I'm in Minneapolis. The police have been very nice here. I went to Amsterdam. In Amsterdam, in the Dutch, what it says on their uniform is polite. And I don't know if that means police, but that's what it says, P-O-L-I-T-E. And when we, you know, saw them and we spoke to them, they were so nice. Now, I'm not saying they weren't you know, keeping law and order, because, you know, Amsterdam can be pretty raucous because folks go to this party because, you know, there's all this marijuana legal over there. So you see lots of folks being silly and crazy and singing and hollering and running around. And you know, but, you know, you don't see, or at least we didn't hear about, and you did not feel when you approached a police officer that you were, when you said hi, that they looked at you like, why are you talking to me? They said, ah, hello, how are you? Are you new to our country? Versus what has happened to me in Chicago, driving my car and not being sure which way to turn or if I can park someplace, asking a white officer, what are you doing? How if I should park here because I'm not sure if it's legal or not. No, it's not legal. Well, I wasn't sure, and I figured you'd know, so that's why I'd ask you. You need to move. I wasn't sure, officer. I'm more than willing to do that. I was asking. That's why I rolled down my window when you pulled up when I was in this parking spot or trying to get in this parking spot. I wanted to ask, was this an appropriate place to park? So thank you very much now for giving me that information.
And there's a difference.
Move it.
Yeah, it's the difference in hostile and hospitable.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, I again had a, this is a young white woman who was a professional student. You know, she was getting a master's in psychology and, you know, when I was teaching at the university, we went to a restaurant and there were all these police officers in the restaurant sitting, eating their lunch. And she immediately got hostile. Well, this was a few years back, and I don't know if you remember, but there was a young white female bartender who refused to serve a police officer, big, burly police officer, and when she refused to serve him because he was intoxicated, with the cameras rolling, he went over the counter and proceeded to beat the mess out of this woman. And he did not get charged for assault. He did not get, you know, suspended from or summarily discharged from the police force. I forget what the charges, how they dealt with him, but it was not seen as, you know, attempted assault or, you know, that he was being totally inappropriate. How is a, you know, man looked like he was close to 300 pounds, the woman looked like she was close to 110, maybe, on a good day, and he's slugging her. How is that ever appropriate? Because she told him...
And not assault and battery.
But she told him, you can't have another drink because you're drunk.
Right.
And that's totally appropriate according to our legal system for a bartender to say that to a patron.
Right.
But he got off. And again, that something happened, but he did not go to jail for assault and battery. And so, you know, this young Caucasian woman who was a psychology, about to get her master's degree or had her master's degree working on a PhD, and I went in to get lunch, and she got real hostile. And then I said, woo, but girl, why are you so upset? Well, I work as a bartender part-time. I make good money, but God, when those cops come in, I have to be afraid. And I was like, whoa. You know, so again, here this, you know, very intelligent, psychologically competent woman, white woman, is reacting to the police like that. How are our black girls going to respond to police officers? Like you say, when they see this in the media, when they get these inappropriate responses when they're on the street. The police say, what are you doing? And the next thing you know, this young woman has a flash of terror. And then the police officers, you know, are, you know, like the young man who they went after and he ultimately died because of how they, you know, took him down and put him in the back of a paddy wagon, and, you know, he bounced all around and damaged his spinal cord. They were allegedly not incorrect for apprehending him, because when they said, hey, man, and he took off running, Mm-hmm. When you run from the police in certain states, they automatically have the right to sustain
to pursue. And, yes. And this what that story just reminds me myself. As a 17-year-old, I just turned 17, attending a Chicago public school, just being in an altercation with a police officer, standing outside. Now, I wasn't committing a crime whatsoever. Standing outside the school, school was over for my grade, which was seniors, but my little sister still had to wait for her. So I couldn't leave the school. I had to wait for my little sister. So I stayed in front of the school and around the school. Police officer comes out, you know, big old 250-pound, and this is a black officer, so I really want people to understand that we're not speaking about race. We do know that, you know, it is systematic racism that, you know, informs all of this. But the perpetrators or police officers or whoever is involved don't necessarily have to be white for
Correct.
Them to impact us. So let me just make that statement. So the police officer was black, 6 feet, at least 250 pounds at least. I stood at 5 foot, and I was 92 pounds on a good day. Standing there, he proceeds to get in my face and yell at me that I need to move, you know, I need to go and move. And I'm explaining to him that I can't, you know, I don't want to leave. I have to wait for my little sister. So he told me about I would move down the street, but then would always make my way back, you know, trying to see if it was time for her to come out. And, of course, I'm not saying that I stood there and was like, no, I can't leave. I definitely was combative. I definitely gave him the same energy he was giving to me. So, obviously, that was absolutely unacceptable to him. He took me, swung me around into a gate. No, first he slapped me with an open hand across my face with all his might. Red handprint on my face. Then he turned me around, so whipped me around and threw me into the gate and handcuffed me and took me back into the building because, you know, that was when well, they're doing it even more now, but that's when they had first started really having the police, like the temporary, yeah, the kind of booking station in the school. So mm-hmm. they took me in the back, and even past the principal, who is looking like, oh, my God, what is going on? You know, uncuff her. At this point, because he has cuffed me without reading me my rights, because he's cuffed me, I'm in his custody now, so it's really not, it's out of the jurisdiction.
Right.
She mm-hmm. can't do anything now. And so he marches me into the back and throws me down into a chair. When my mother comes, they slam the door on her and tell her absolutely she can't come out because I made 17. So, in Chicago, 17 is no longer a minor. All of this to say, Dr. Crawford, that I can tell you that it has taken me many, many years to have an open and trusting relationship with police. I don't want to see them. I try my best to avoid any interaction with them up until a few years ago. Now, this happened to me as a child. So I know that if that happened to me, plus me seeing and every day seeing officers stop, you know, my boyfriends, and they have to get out their cars, and everybody's throwing up against the hot hood of the cars and all the other things, that all this stuff continues to inform our reaction. So we know we have girls who, like me, have also been, you know, at the receiving end of police overzealousness, police just, you know, acting, you know, as you said, absurdly. How then, what should we as a community, what should our school officials know, what should our families know, how can we help our girls to understand what is appropriate between the police, what they should expect in their relations with the police, and then also how to counter the effects that we know girls are having when they see these negative realities, really, because, I mean, they're in the media, but it's not something that's made up. It is true. These are not, you know, falsified events. They see the YouTube videos. They see, you know, the eyewitness accounts that somebody has captured. How do we counter that to shore them up and encourage them and really to foster them, their resiliency, as you spoke about earlier?
Well, I think we have to teach our children in general, our girls in particular, that when the police address you, you stand still, you turn towards the officer, and you say, "Yes, sir. May I help you? What's your request?" Now, that doesn't mean you do everything they say, but you respond in a very respectful way. And they, if they ask you to go with them, then, you know, you say, "Sir, respectfully, I would like to call my parents and my attorney. There is my understanding that it is my legal right as a minor that I do not have to be questioned or answer you unless my parents or an attorney are present." Someone, some adult is responsible to, you know, to help me to respond appropriately to you. And legally, they have to do that. But you have to say it, and you have to say it in an assertive but a calm and respectful way. And it's unfortunate, but that's the best thing to do, to not say anything unless you, and if they say, "Stop, who are you?" You turn, you stop, "Sir, thank you, sir. I'm sorry, sir. I do not feel comfortable in answering any questions unless I have my parents or an attorney present. I am blah, blah, blah age. Sir, can you cooperate?" Right.
And that would be the legal response, right? So we know that that's what we do. We do the training so that they understand how to respond. But how? What do we need to be doing as teachers, you know, as parents, as those who serve girls? What should we be doing to kind of counter the negative impact on their psyche, you know, on their psyche, their mental wellness? How do we keep them inspired? How do we keep their resiliency up after they've witnessed all of this outside stuff? As you said, maybe they shut down and they don't respond to adults or authority when they feel something is wrong, or they see something, or they have an opinion. How do we keep that elevated so that they don't silence their voices and they continue to speak out, that they continue to make good choices so that they do feel safe and not venture off into wrongdoing or with the wrong crowd because this is safe? How do we deal with that?
Well, I think as parents and as a community, and I think this is a place where the Black church maybe can be there also, is that, you know, when parents get the call, your child has been taken to the police station, you know, well, if they did something wrong, I'm just going to leave them there. You don't know what they did. They need you to be there to be their voice, not to go and necessarily even to defend, but to at least go and ask respectfully, "What are the charges?" And again, reiterate, "This is my child's right." You know, I know when Michael Garner, when the jury, you know, decided they were the grand jury decided they weren't going to indict the police officers who put Michael Garner in a chokehold, and he subsequently died as a result of their action. When that, you know, verdict came back, the church I attend, I think we both attend, we did a protest, and before we walked out in mass on the street to the L station to lay in the street in peaceful protest, we were told, "Police approach you, don't give any response except, 'Thank you. This is our legal, you know, representative. Please call them, and we'll be glad to cooperate. They'll be glad to cooperate with you.' I don't have anything else to say. Thank you." Mm-hmm. And at least that was my recollection of what we were told. That you don't have to respond, you don't have to do, but you have to say, you know, "This is who you can call. I understand it's my legal right to call this person." And again, the church had obtained legal representation. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that's an attorney who's going to follow you all through court. But 9 cases out of 10, when people are incarcerated, they get incarcerated because of those initial statements that they make. So if you don't say anything, if you don't admit to anything, if you don't give any details or extra information besides your name and the name of the adult to be contacted, then they can't do anything else. But then the parent, the community has to say, I am going to trust that my young person wants to do the right thing, that there has been a misunderstanding, and I am here to facilitate the untangling of this misunderstanding so we can set things right. Does that mean your child is always in the right? No. But it does mean that your child needs to have an advocate, and you're willing to be there as their advocate to voice
and that's the word.
Their perception.
That's the word. Mm-hmm. Advocate, yes. And so we know from what you're saying, it's obvious that if when children know, when they know how things should go, when they understand that somebody will be there for you, when they understand the proper steps that they can take to kind of, you know, at least do their best to de-escalate, then that does make them feel safer. But let's talk about the girls who have never had an encounter with the police. They've not had any interactions with the police personally themselves, but they have seen these messages over in the images in the media. They've heard the stories. They've seen everything, and they're sitting in a classroom or they're sitting in a program. What should I as a mentor, what should I as a teacher, what should I as a program director, what should I as a mother do or say prior to any interaction, just so that, as you talked about before, there's not this, I want to say apathetic or hopeless demeanor about our girls, that they feel victims or they feel as if they are powerless. How can we avoid that, even though, you know, this thing is on repeat? You know, there's this repetition of the images of seeing girls beaten and brutalized and even killed. How do we counter that? What can we do? What can we say? What should our programming involve to help us counter that? Even if it's not involving law enforcement per se, it's the authority figure at our school, whoever it is. How do we keep their voices lifted so that they're not feeling dejected and hopeless, as if they don't have a voice and that they're powerless?
Well, again, I think we, as mentors, as individuals who are working with young people in school, say, well, you know, unfortunately, and again, I've actually done this in a situation where I was on a phone conference call where I had a student who was asking for an individualized educational plan, and this youngster had not been in school for weeks because she felt she had been bullied and the school had not responded to her. And therefore, she didn't want to come to school. And their position was, well, you cannot be absent repeatedly. We don't care if you're afraid. You have to be in school. Mm-hmm. And so they came up with a way that they thought would make her feel safe. And in the middle of the conference call, I said, wait. Where's that girl? We need to ask her what will make her feel safe. Get her in there. So they got the student, and they said, well, we want to know what you think. She said, no, you don't. You haven't asked me before. So I'm on the phone, and I said, ooh, baby girl, I'm here. You know how I am.
Mm-hmm.
Tell them what you would like. I will help you work with them to get what's going to help you feel comfortable and safe, with the ultimate goal being you getting back into school so you can get your education, because that's what we're supposed to all be about. And
mm-hmm.
if you're too afraid to be in the school, it doesn't make any difference if somebody thinks, oh, well, let's let her go sit in the lunchroom and do her homework. If you don't feel safe in the lunchroom by yourself, it doesn't make any difference if the teacher thinks that's a wonderful idea. So
right.
Tell us what you think to help you feel comfortable, and let me then be your voice to try to negotiate to get closest to a solution that will work for you. You don't have to fuss with them. You don't have to fight with them. Speak what you want. Sit back and trust that I am going to try to get that for you. And so that's what we did. And I would say, okay, so you can do blah, 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 blah to the school staff. And they said, yes, we can do this. So I said, where's baby girl? Baby girl, does that sound close enough? And she's like, well, no, because, you know, they're going to have me in with a teacher who's going to help me with my work, but then I have stuff to go back into class with those same kids. I don't want to do that. So then we worked out that she could come into class after school, after the class started, so she didn't have to be in the hallways. She didn't have to be jostling to get into class with people. She could come in a little bit later, leave a little bit earlier, go to the nurse's office or someplace and just go to three classes for a while and then be in a school club, and in that way establish a relationship with some of the positive kids in the class. Mm-hmm. So then when she felt she was about to be bullied, she could go be with the positive kid or else go to the nurse's office or the counselor's office and say, you know, I don't feel comfortable. Can you walk me into class a little bit later? And then ask the teacher if I can leave a little bit early because I don't want to have any contact with this person in the hallway. And we were able to negotiate that, but I was her voice. Mm-hmm. And so more and more mentors, other adults, because so many times you hear adults, well, when I was a child and this is the way you should do it. But again, with this youngster, she was afraid to go to school, but she was willing to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea specifically what made her afraid. I just knew she was scared. But she didn't. She wasn't trying to avoid classwork. She was doing the classwork that was given to her at home. But she did not feel comfortable going in and out of that class with certain peers. So we had to find out what her fears were. And then, again, she didn't get out of going to school, but we tried to amend her program to help her feel more comfortable. And eventually she got to the point that she just went to class on a regular basis like everybody else. And indeed, I think it was her senior year or junior year, and it went beautifully. The next year she went, she graduated.
So I heard three things in that. I heard one is genuine concern, that we need to have genuine concern about the safety and well-being and psychological well-being. I think people, unfortunately, we always talk about, you know, physical safety, but I think just in that instance, what you just talked about, not just feeling bullied, you know, physically, but anything that stresses or causes some type of anxiety for our young people, we need to know and be very aware of it and show a genuine concern. So whether it's in an organization, Girl Scouts or something, whether it's in a school classroom, wherever you have girls, you should show genuine concern about those girls, especially our girls who we know are targeted and are at the center of negative media images and negative societal issues. And then two, I heard you say that girls need advocates, they need mentors who they know will be present and speak up for them. And then three, I heard you also say that you have to ask and get the input of our girls. They have to feel like their voices matter and that we'll listen to them. Am I right?
And that doesn't mean, again, if she had said, well, I don't want to have to go to school. I just want them to give me the grades. I would have said, as her advocate, come on now. Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's really right?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you not have to do the work? But she and she was willing to do the work. So given that she was willing to do the work, I could say honestly to the school staff, oh, no, she wants to be a good student. This is getting in the way of her being a good student. And if you see that she's falling down on the job of being a good student, something else is going on. We need to have this conversation again so we can find out what's getting in the way. Because she's, and I honestly believe her, she wants to be a good student. That's not even an issue on the table. Well, she's lazy. She doesn't look like she knows what's going on. And I've had, just tell me that. She doesn't look like she knows what's going on. Looks like she's in her own world. Well, she may be, but that doesn't mean she's not listening. That doesn't mean she hasn't done the work. That doesn't mean that she can't answer your question. It just means that right now she's so wrapped up in how she feels, she can't be a part of the normal discourse in the classroom. And sometimes the normal discourse in the classroom can be rough.
Yes, it can, especially when you have triggers for other things. And that brings me to another question. So let's say that you do have, you are you have a classroom or whatever you're facilitating for young people. What are some signs you should be looking for a child who may be actually dealing with some PTSD from too much internalizing too much of the media that they're seeing, as we talk about systemic racism and police and law enforcement and girls, or even having the everyday reality of navigating their community dealing with the police. What can we look for in terms of what some of those symptoms, I guess that's the word, what should we be looking for, like behaviors that will let us know that, okay, we need to address this, that you know.
Well, again, I think, you know, in the school situation, the issue is what's going on? Are you feeling like you're capable of learning? Then what's getting in the way of you being able to demonstrate that you can learn and you can be an excellent student? And what do you feel is getting in your way right now versus why aren't you doing it? No. Do you feel you're capable? Do you feel there's anything else that you need to become a more competent student? And if you feel like you're a competent student and you understand the information, then what's getting in the way of you demonstrating it? You know, one of the things I've talked to people about, you know, and again, at the university, my research was on disruptive behavior disorders. And there is a psychologist, Alan Kasdan, out of New York, I think he is. And one of the simple things he did with families that have been seen as noncompliant was before they started therapy, asked, what do you think might get in the way of you coming to therapy? And by asking them in advance, before they started missing sessions, then he could have his staff say, oh, so you don't think you're going to have car fare? Okay. What do you think will help? And not necessarily giving them the car fare, but saying, is it better for you to come in the morning or is it better for you to come in the afternoon? Because we can tie that to some other transaction for which you have car fare, and therefore, you know, it's not going to be such a, you know, burden on you, or is it you need child care or your kids need to get fed? What is it you need to help you come to therapy? Do you think that there's another family member who's sick, who needs your attention, and you can't engage in therapy right now for this child because your mother's sick, or you got a grandparent that you got to take care of, or you've got a job that at this point in time, you're afraid that you may lose your job if you take off early or, you know, have to miss days? What do you think might get in the way of you being able to come in and address this problem? I think if we do that more and more in advance, I know this is sometimes going to be hard, but asking the young person, what might get in the way of you being able to do what the expectation of you is? Because I believe you can do this, but just because I believe it doesn't mean that it's possible for you right now. Not that you don't want to, but it may not be possible for you right now. What is getting in the way of you being able to meet this expectation?
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask that in a non-judgmental way and say, let's see what we can do to help you work this out, it's amazing what kinds of things happen. You know, again, I work with a group of young ladies doing a group at an alternative school, and at one point, I don't know if it was the midpoint or at the end of the group sessions we had planned, I bought document frames for each one of the young ladies and gave it to them wrapped in, you know, graduation gift paper saying, this is for your high school diploma. It is my expectation that you will get a high school diploma. Do you know one of the young ladies, her mother, in the midst of her senior year in the alternative school, decided she was going to move out of state. And this young lady said, oh, no, this is the closest I've ever been to achieving my academic goals. If you move out of state, I got to find somebody I can live with here because I want to finish high school. I want to put my diploma in this frame. Saw her at the African Fest in August. Oh, baby girl, did you graduate? Yep. Well, wait, are you going to go live with your mom in Wisconsin?
oh, no, I'm going to move back. What? Her mother moved out, was in Wisconsin for a couple months. Whatever didn't work out, she moved back.
Mm.
And now she's living with her mom. But if she had gone with her mom to Wisconsin and left school and then mom moved back, she would have missed out on the opportunity to get that high school diploma.
Mm-hmm.
But because she said respectfully, no, this is my goal, I want to meet this goal, her mother let her stay. They found a family friend or someone who she could stay with for, because I think it was only like 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So she finished her diploma. And like I said, by, if this was, if her mom moved in March, I saw her again in August. She got her diploma in June. By the time I saw her in August, her mom had moved back into the city.
Mm-hmm. And so that scenario, you can definitely apply that to anything. So if we're talking about girls who, you know, maybe you're in a classroom or in a setting where you feel like you see things, but this girl is not very talkative. She doesn't, you know, doesn't raise her hand or doesn't even question anything. When you know that there's some unfairness, she doesn't speak up. So you can kind of see that, you know, she's been silenced a little. You definitely can probe and say, how can we help you? What can we do to help you participate more? How can we make you feel more comfortable voicing your opinion? You want to look for those opportunities and let them say what it is that, you know, how they feel like they can fit in better, how they can speak to anything that they're feeling, how they can express themselves and articulate their emotions. You set that, you want to set, do that setting. Okay.
And then let them tell you what they think would help. Because again, somebody might say, oh, your mother's moving. Well, you have to move with your mother. No, she didn't. But because you think that's the appropriate thing, you may have suggested that, but that wasn't the most appropriate thing. There have been so many situations, I can think Hyde Park, Kenwood, where they have had young women who were valedictorians or salutatorians of their high school graduating class, and they were not living with parental figures for 2, 3, 4 years of high school.
Yeah. And some have parents who are incarcerated, so they don't have a choice. So we know that they have to make, you know, have to have adjustments, and they know best what works for them.
Right.
Help me help you is what we should be thinking about moving, dealing
mm-hmm.
with our girls. Help me help you.
Yeah.
Well, I so appreciate you having this conversation, Dr. Crawford. I know for sure that girls not only in Texas and Ohio, but also Chicago, Brooklyn, Baltimore, St. Louis, Detroit, Compton, Oakland, girls all over our country are needing to really unpack what they're seeing every day in the news. And questions like those are girls like me, and that this could happen to me. And being able to unpack and have every aspect of our community covering our girls so that when they come into any space that they feel protected, that they feel as if someone will stand for them. And I appreciate you helping us to better be equipped to do that. Thank you so much for joining Voices of Advocacy Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. And then our next conversation is going to have to be bicycling.
Yes, because, you know, I truly believe, as I told you before, that exercise in any form, you know, my preference is bicycling. But when girls are active and they can really do that, I think that also helps them form a sisterhood. I think it helps them exert some energy. And it also kind of helps them just see the city that, or places that they've not been exposed to for whatever reason. The city looks much different when you're on a bicycle, you know, riding along Lakeshore Drive or wherever it is. So we definitely have to do that. I just really, really, really appreciate everything you do, Dr. Crawford. And also, can you let the listeners know any projects that you're working on, any research that you have, or, you know, just where you are and what your focus is right now?
Well, I don't have any research projects going on currently, but I'm really excited about using the bicycle as a tool for helping for youth development and developing a healthier community.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a mayor here in Chicago who is directing funds. He's not spending money, but he's directing our funds to towards, you know, having wonderful bike trails that are not just on the lakefront, but in the communities,
mm-hmm.
in many different parts of the city, or in the, you know, near suburban area with our forest preserves in the Cook County system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been amazing to me working with the Major Taylor Club,
mm-hmm.
which is another whole thing of history about who Major Taylor was, African-American male who was a bicyclist at the turn of the century, who was making millions of dollars in Europe competing, couldn't compete in the United States consistently because of racism, and Black Girls Do Bike here in Chicago.
Yeah.
And the camaraderie, and then here at the National Brotherhood of Cyclists, I met women, you know, met one young woman who's now become a bicycle mechanic, and she's making $13 to $15 an hour, still, you know, junior, senior in high school.
Well, I have to get her on next, too. Maybe need to get her on the show, too, and have her talk about that, too.
Yeah, it's you know, again, it's such a warm and helpful camaraderie. You know, people say, oh, you don't look real good. You know, the way your bike is squeaking when you put on the brakes. Let's go take a look at that so we can oil it up and help you out. So, you know, I haven't had people who've been that warm and receptive and so demonstrably helpful in many situations. I think it'd be wonderful to have, you know, a young girl's Black Girls Do Bike organization, or Red, Black, and Green, or Floral Chicago, because there are a number of different opportunities, Major Taylor Youth Program, where, you know, young women can get involved in biking. And it's transportation, it's cheap transportation, and it's exercise.
It is, and I know girls like me will definitely be instrumental in collaborating and make sure that we get as many girls directed to that program as possible. And, of course, as I said, biking is my second love next to reading, so I will definitely be involved as well. So
okay.
Thank you again, Dr. Crawford. And where can everybody get in contact with you? Is there a website? Are you on Twitter or Facebook or anything like that?
I'm working on that. But right now I'm at Cam Alliance, and that's the letter K, the letter A, the letter M, and the word Alliance. And
okay.
Their website, I'm working at their agency, and we're trying to get some more programming to give psychological support to especially to young people, but actually starting some young women's groups for young women who are dealing with mental health issues right in the Roseland area.
Yes, and we so appreciate you, Dr. Crawford. We know just in terms of the news how much mental health has to be a priority, how much we need to talk about it, how much we need to deal with it, and how much we need to treat and also be aware of it within our own communities, our own family, our own circle. So, again, I am so grateful to you and your service, your gift for, you know, not everybody can deal with young people. Not everybody cares enough or remembers when they were children to have that type of patience and concern and compassion. So thank you for all that you do. Thank you for taking the time out for Voices of Advocacy Radio. Just appreciate you so much.
Okay, you take care.